This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your I Don't Go Outside of music news and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. You may have noticed that we did not get to the year-end Jazzcast at the end of 2020 for a variety of reasons, but that does not mean that Popcast does not ride with jazz. Does not mean that. Only that we are briefly delayed in talking about a lot of the interesting things that have been going on last year and in recent years in jazz and in jazz-adjacent and jazz-minded spaces. So this week, we are going to talk about some exciting records that came out on Blue Note, International Anthem, some hip hop that is very, very jazz minded. We're going to talk about how the Academy can ossify things that should not be ossified. We're going to talk about how growing up or studying or learning your trade out in certain scenes is really the most vital way of gaining knowledge and also reproducing it and innovating upon it. To have these conversations, Gio Russinello is going to call in. Gio, as you know, writes about jazz for the New York Times. We are also going to talk to Marcus J. Moore. Marcus writes about music for the Times, The Nation, a bunch of places. We're going to talk about some big picture things that are happening in the world of jazz. Welcome to the Jazz Cast, Gio and Marcus.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Of course.
What's going on?
Gio, happy to have you. We opened with a little bit of that Emmanuel Wilkins record. Gio, let's start with you. This was your number one album of 2020. I know we are post-hierarchy, but that still means something. Talk to me a little bit about what spoke to you so intensely about this record.
Talking about this record is also kind of talking about a little scene of Juilliard grads and otherwise, like young musicians who are hyper literate in the tradition, who are coming up, are in their early to mid 20s in New York City, and are making something together that both engages with the jazz tradition as sort of the trunk of the tree and this accepted notion, and also tugs it forward in a way that feels so organic that you don't really even get the anxiety factor, you know, that you often get with musicians working around the edges of a tradition that they're in love with, but they're also critical of. Basically, I mean, by going down into essentially the depths of like straight ahead jazz, you know, swing and that tradition, while also experiencing a lot in terms of modern gospel, in terms of hip hop, and in terms of resisting hip hop and sort of like the cycles of conversation that are going on in America, you know, and specifically in Black American music today, and being pretty comfortable with the idea that you can do that while also being in love with this fascinating intellectual musical tradition, you know, that people are drawn to. So in that way, he's just a musician. Emmanuel Wilkins, this young alto sax player, is just an incredible original voice with a sense that he can say what he wants to say.
Marcus, when we had our little pre-conversation, this was a record you were very keen on, and I wonder if you could talk about what struck you so much about it.
I had the honor of actually writing the bio for this, you know, before it even came out. So I had an opportunity to sort of sit with it for a long period of time. And also just a point of order, and I'm probably aging myself a little bit, you know, safe space. right. So it's like, you know, before when I was listening to it and I'm looking at the liner notes and I see that the drummer is Kwaku Sumbri. I actually know his parents. I know I'm friends with Diallo and Maisha, his parents. And I remember Kwaku walking into the open mics in D.C. like well before he was supposed to be coming in there and just killing it and just killing it. And so, like, I say all that to say, you know, he still brings that same energy to this record. And this overall, you know, this Emmanuel Wilkins album, it reminds me of the sort of rise of Black Lives Matter. It also kind of touches into the protests, you know, because it came out at the time of like George Floyd got killed and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, and you had the uprisings from there. So, man, to me, it really strikes me as a political record, like an overtly political record, but it isn't so in your face with it. Like it talks to the tone, you know, it sort of speaks to the tone of what's going on. But at the same time, it doesn't. It sort of opens itself up for other conversations as well.
One song on this album that really jumped out at me was Mary Turner, An American Tradition. And to your point about the overt political quality of the record, the kind of physicality of that song, the tense energy in it, I found it really, really bracing and very welcome. And I kind of wished I had even heard this album. You know, Gio, you and I talk about this intermittently over the various months, but I often have to play catch up when it comes to the jazz podcast. So, you know, I apologize for that in advance, but this was a record I would have been really excited to hear months ago, but I'm really glad that I did hear it now.
You said that last year, I think, about Joel Ross, and they're like really, you know, close. In fact, Emmanuel was on that record. You said the same thing on last year's podcast, which I love. I love that thread because you're right. They're both.
Gio, do I like jazz? Is that the secret?
You like the stuff that's in conversation. You know, they're in conversation with each other and with a lot. And yeah, Marcus, like the tone thing. That's so right. I mean, how much can be conveyed through an instrument without using anything related to language? Even, I mean, related. You know, but like not even syntactical in the same way as language, but saying so much with the tone. I think of Coltrane and On Back, right?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, Emmanuel Wilkins is just sort of like this continuation of those artists. He, you know, to me, he sort of strikes the same tone as like the liberation jazz from the late 60s and early 70s. You know, I think he's doing that, but like you said at the top of the convo, like it's also in conversation with hip hop. It, you know, obviously it has some soul in there. So the thing that I love about this record is that, again, it's striking such a very serious tone with, like, you know, Mary Turner, Guarded Heart and things like that. But it's just a freedom of expression. It isn't trying to be one thing. It just feels very natural.
Gio, you mentioned when you were describing the record that Emmanuel went to Juilliard. And it reminded me of something that you had written last year about institutional training in jazz and sort of the shortcomings of institutional training, which Juilliard may or may not be a part of. I don't know. But I wonder if you maybe can pick that thread up a little bit and talk about that conversation, because it does seem a particularly necessary one to have, especially in wake of what the last year has looked like.
Before I totally answer, one other thing you said, Marcus, that would set up this answer kind of perfectly, I think. You mentioned where you had first heard Kwaku Sumbri, who's like so crucial to that Emmanuel Wilkins record. You had first heard him at open mics in DC, and I'm from DC as well. And I wondered which, and if you could like describe the room.
It was at Live.
That's so funny. I was going to say, was it at Bohemian?
It was upstairs. Yeah, it was at the Up and Up open mic, man. So it's just this room of like, you know, you had this room of like this, it's different kinds of creators. You had writers, you had poets, you had, you know, you name it. And he was a kid, because his father used to be in this band called Farafina Khan, which is like this African drum ensemble. And he would come in there and he would play the djembe. So, yeah, the room, which is very, I guess, you know, to describe it, is very Pan-African. You know, it was a very Pan-African vibe in there every Tuesday night.
Right. Which means, like you said, so many different kinds of things going on, right? In this open room with like listeners, you know. And when I was at Live, sometimes performances like would kind of spill out into the crowd, you know. I mean, it just sort of is that natural space, depending on like how big the band is, whether it can fit on the stage and stuff like that. So compare that to the Academy today, which is where, with a
that
capital
was slick.
J, we
I see
call,
what you did there, Gio.
Which is, I mean, it's just head, it's just like head explodingly frustrating to think about this, because it's just so different than how the music is being carried on out in the world, you know, in the community. It's like broadly out in the world, but also specifically in the places where it's always grown, which is, you know, cities and Black communities across the country mostly. And whoever wants to come and join that party has always been welcome, you know, like generally, with certain important exceptions. But like, that's just not the vibe of the Academy. So what we have is essentially a like a sort of a classical music department in every major conservatory in the country that has now kind of replicated its model in terms of learning repertory, in terms of learning instrumental skill according to certain parameters, in terms of passing on kind of library of licks and like a library of languages. All of that is done in a very like specific way, you know, just put it that way. And when musicians who were doing something really wildly inventive in the 60s wanted entry into that, when that thing was being built in the academy, they were absolutely told no. They were invited in for a couple of years, and then it got out of hand that they sort of wanted to do exactly what Marcus just described, but with resources. And that was sort of shut down.
Are there no university level or conservatory level jazz programs that welcome that impulse towards unpredictability, wooliness, complete boundary pushing? Like, I don't know enough, obviously, about the specifics of each program, but are most of them, like you said, library of licks is a really interesting phrase. Are most of them very much conserved with preserving a kind of a canon that predates even the existence of that program or an ideology?
Interestingly, I think the fact that they're still preserving an old canon speaks not directly just to itself, but to the fact that like the system itself is not a place that has allowed new standards to be written. Like the music has been held in place because while you're in that program, you can't really figure out your own thing. It's very hard to do. In a way, at least, that's going to communicate. I mean, everybody's writing tunes, but yeah.
Okay, so here's an amateur question, right? Talking about new standards. Do you feel that if such new standards exist, that they're primarily coming from elsewhere?
I actually want to, you know, answer this question by sort of answering the last question. I literally, a couple of days ago, had a conversation with the brother, Shabaka Hutchings, because he has a new record coming out in a few months. And he was talking very specifically about that, where he was like, he was in uni and he would try to play jazz records. You know, he would try to play these jazz standards and his professor would speak against it. You know, he'd be like, okay, get some of the jazz out because we're playing classical, you know? And so there's always been this notion, for whatever reason, that jazz is frowned upon, whereas, you know, classical music, that's what we ought to be playing. And he was saying that he didn't really learn how to play until he started going to these different communities, you know, until he started just kind of jamming in these different venues in Birmingham, England. And, you know, and as a result, that's where he got his education. So I was listening to Gio's last answer and I was like, this is exactly what Shabaka was talking about, where for whatever reason, the standards just aren't respected as much as they should be. So I feel like there's this new vanguard of musicians like Emmanuel Wilkins, like Shabaka and, you know, Kwaku and everybody, who are creating their own standards, you know? And I think that's eventually where the music is going to go. You know, you have this new undercurrent of musicians who are sort of breaking the rules and doing their own thing, which in and of itself is jazz music. You know, it's music that evolves. It's not supposed to stay in the same place forever and ever.
This is probably the right time to talk about the Shabaka and the Ancestors record that came out last year.
Yeah, that record was crazy.
Okay, so that's called We Are Sent Here by History. What's a good track to listen to kind of get the energy of this record?
Honestly, they always hit really strong on the first track. So yeah, the very first track, actually, They Who Must Die.
All right, They Who Must Die, Shabaka and the Ancestors. Marcus, can you talk a little bit about what Shabaka Hutchings has been doing over the last 3-4 years? I know we've spoken about him, Gio, on prior jazz podcasts, but Marcus, pick up the thread a little bit about the last couple years for Shabaka.
Oh man, he's been doing everything. That's the thing. Like, you know, he has 3 different bands, Shabaka and the Ancestors, which is more spiritual jazz leaning. He also has, and it's not his band, but he's in The Comet Is Coming, which is more sort of a cosmic jazz electronica sort of situation. And then he has Sons of Kemet, which is sort of like a Caribbean dance, you know, more like dance hall leaning. he's been essentially trying to declassify his music. So, you know, he says, like, you know, even though he identifies as a jazz musician, it makes it more difficult for critics like us to even classify what he's doing sonically.
And how much of that has to do with place? We've been kind of touching on place and place versus institution. How much of that has to do with place?
I think with him, it's pretty essential because he's a guy who is originally from Barbados, but then he moved to Birmingham, England, and now he lives just outside of London. And so he comes from these environments where they don't classify music by genre. You know, like he always says, if you're in Barbados and you play the clarinet, you just play the clarinet on whatever music, you know, you're not playing calypso or reggae. So for him, I think it's just comes from him just naturally wanting to sort of declassify his sound. It's because that's essentially how he came up, you know. So I feel like for him, place is everything because he's also a person who you see everywhere and you see he's doing all kinds of music. And it doesn't matter what kind of music it is. Like this Sons of Kemet record is like a, you know, it's more like, I don't even think it's jazz. I don't even know what it is. You know, it's a little bit of everything. So place for him is just, you know, wherever he makes it, to be honest.
Can we actually just listen, just out of selfishness? Can we listen to just a quick Sons of Kemet song from that album? Maybe My Queen is Anna Julia Cooper.
When we were talking about repertory and stuff, I think you mentioned how important Shabaka had said it was for him to sort of break out of just going to school and kind of going back to Barbados and spending years there in his, I think, adolescence, really kind of formative for him musically. And it made me think about the same thing being true of Etienne Charles when he talks about playing at Carnival in Trinidad, where he's from, or like even J.D. Allen in Detroit, like kind of coming to the avant-garde outside of the institutions, you know, like, it is, like you said, it's place. It's like everything. It's just a way for musicians to engage more broadly, I think, whether it's what you described about the open mics in DC or like, yeah, being on an avant-garde scene. There's just a completely different set of terms. And that's kind of how new repertory often gets made. But it doesn't necessarily even need to be about repertory. It can also just be about a way of playing that's passed on. The question for me about writing that whole piece about the Academy was like, how fortified and closed and protected is the way of playing here, you know, and how does that differ from what it means to like make music in the world? We were sort of in the pre-show chat, we were talking a little bit about maybe discussing like other kinds of music that are like kind of semi-related to jazz. And it's elsewhere that I think people just sort of naturally interact. And in jazz, it's like you start interacting with the world through your music, and somehow people who have been taught that they get to police this music start to say, well, how interesting. Let's pause. Let's stop. Let's think about this. Are you really doing this other thing too? You know, it's like, it's almost like you have to go through the gate and pay some kind of toll or something.
I feel like this comes up a lot in our conversations, Gio, and I don't love to kind of drop a big question bomb on y'all that then just ends up being like sprawling and kind of unmanageable. But there is this tension, and you talk about it in that piece, and it's something that I think is experienced in many other genres. It's certainly experienced in hip hop. I would say it's experienced in country and in certain strains of indie rock. There is always a generation, and I want to say it's often the generation that's maybe the first post-innovator generation, like post-flag-planting generation, who, as they grow up, what they want to do is canonize, is not necessarily the right word, but hold fast to a way of doing things. And then there can be this schism between that generation, which in its youth was radical, and the next radical generation who is saying, I acknowledge the debt to your generation, but also we're going to do it completely our own way. So that thing where the radical generation becomes institutionalized or quasi-institutionalized, sort of there's this protectionist impulse. And I think part of what you're talking about in that piece is that the institutionalization of it through academia has been so detrimental to creativity, or very detrimental, that truly seeking musicians, musicians who are out there actively pushing, find themselves having to almost turn their backs entirely, even if there's something that they want to take from that stuff or want to work with. They're better served turning their backs on it. Is that an overread?
Well, what's been fascinating to me is that, first of all, I think the musicians who are doing that, who are conscientiously like, I'm totally not going to go through with this academy-driven sort of expertise model, like even trying to do things like outside of their main instrument, maybe to break away from it, you know, there's that. I think the musicians who are really pushing against it, it's an interesting thing where in terms of the third generation, I feel like the next one is going to be the one that's building on them to actually do something that's newly what you termed like an innovative generation. I think we still have that ahead in a lot of ways when it comes to like that melding of jazz, hip hop, et cetera. I think we're still gestating away from the academy there. But I feel like in terms of what Emmanuel Wilkins has done, and there's also, we haven't mentioned enough the sort of role Georgia Ann Muldrow is playing in that generation, right? She's sort of like maybe the closest thing we have to a really great innovator. You said that thing about like, about just ditching, you know, the tradition. And that's what's so fascinating about Joel Ross and Emmanuel Wilkins and a bunch of musicians around them, Kanoa Mendenhall and Micah Thomas. They're not rejecting it. They're doing something within it that's kind of breaking it and is amazing.
Yeah. No, I feel like, especially nowadays, you know, there is this notion to sort of break away from what the forefathers did while also acknowledging their contributions. And I think what you were talking about in your question is totally a thing that somebody like Robert Glasper calls jazz police, where there's this segment of the population who never even wanted jazz to evolve from the 40s and the 50s. So, you know, whenever Miles Davis plugged in his trumpet, and then whenever Herbie Hancock pretty much discarded jazz for a funk, and, you know, Pharoah Sanders, they were calling his saxophone wails elephant shrieks. There's this sort of class of people who like, oh, well, it doesn't necessarily align with my nostalgia. So it's not that the music isn't good. It's just like, oh, I didn't grow up with this. And it's the same thing in hip hop. I mean, I grew up as a hip hop head in the 80s. And obviously, you know, we all know these stuck in the 90s cats who are like, oh, to them, the music died with Biggie and Mobb Deep and all these people. And the sad thing is that, well, not the sad thing, but I think the good thing is that you have a younger class of musician in rap and jazz who are sort of ignoring that. Like, they acknowledge what went on before them, but they're taking bits and pieces of the past and melding it with the present and making it something totally different. And so, to my mind, especially, you know, just in the rap category, somebody like Pink Sifu and somebody else like Earl Sweatshirt sort of speaks to that specifically.
I want to get to both Pink Sifu and Earl a little bit later in the conversation, but I do think it's interesting because I occasionally will find myself in dialogue with someone who is carrying the 90s so heavily in hip hop. It's almost like a burden, right? Because it becomes this kind of like immobile obstacle around which you can't navigate. And obviously, on the one hand, when I have those conversations, I want to appeal to their, what I imagine is some kind of like gut level sense of radicalism where I'm like, okay, well, you remember what it was like to be 14, 16, 18, 20 and be like, this is my music. We're doing it differently. This is my generation. And I was like, you have to allow the kids who are 14, 16, 18, 20 now to have that version, even if it's in opposition to, even if it thumbs its nose at our tradition generationally, you know? But sometimes that can be a hard sell for, you know, someone who's holding tight to the idea that their approach to the genre, whatever the genre be, is the canonical one. One of the things that middle age has taught me is that we are all burdened by our own canons, and we could all do really well to unburden ourselves of them. It's really the only way to be thinking about music in a holistic way. Anyway, jumping off my soapbox now.
Yeah. No, I'm with you.
I appreciate that.
Georgia Ann Muldrow, we should talk about how much she is a bridge to those kinds of musicians that kind of thinking, first of all, and like putting that into practice, like that loving use of a tradition in a way that's like, here's what I need. Here's what I don't need. Here's what I need. I'll take that. I'll take Mingus. I'll take Abby Lincoln. Maybe I'll take Mobb Deep. Like, it all sort of like comes up.
Yeah. Talk about the record. It's called Mama, You Can Bet. It's under an alter ego.
Jyoti, which is her jazz project. She's used a number of times now. And by jazz, I guess she just means she leans into maybe playing a few more acoustic instruments and like really following her improvisational sense. And I mean, it's not like she's not playing beats either, but she's doing it all kind of, it's more mercurial, right? Like it sort of morphs a little bit more Quicksilver, you know, than some of her other stuff, which just stays more on a boom bap, like a dreamy boom bap, you know?
Let's listen to something off this record. What should we listen to?
We should listen to the title track, Mama, You Can Bet, because not only is she talking about exactly what the record is, she's unpacking the mission statement, but it also gets into the sorts of swing jazz that she was influenced by when she was creating the record.
Let's listen. Mama, You Can Bet, Jyoti, Georgia Ann Muldrow.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
Talking about Georgia Ann Muldrow, we're talking about Los Angeles, we're talking about Leimert Park. Marcus, I know we're going into territory that's very close and dear to your heart. You want to talk about that scene and how she functions in and around that set of musicians that has become so vital in the last few years.
Oh, man. Now, the thing about Georgia, and I'm so glad we're talking about her, is like, you know, at least 5 years ago, 6 years ago now, almost 6 years ago, we were having this conversation that, oh, jazz is back. You know, jazz has made a return. And, you know, maybe it's because I just spent a whole lot of time with the subject. But I talked to people and they were like, because it was, you know, Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly had so much jazz on it and it was an L.A. jazz record. Featuring like, you know, Terrace Martin and Thundercat and all these guys from the LA scene. And then you had Kamasi Washington's The Epic come out 2 months later. But even before that, Georgia was creating this sort of jazz hybrid, almost not even in silence, but she was creating this style of jazz for a long time before it was in the national conversation, in the mainstream conversation. So I feel like Georgia is definitely a throwback, like you said, to like old school Leimert Park. So when I hear her music, I hear Mingus, I hear Horace Tapscott, I hear Kamal Daoud and all these people that you see at the world stage, man. So I think she's definitely carrying on those traditions in a way that people like a certain level of jazz listener can totally identify with what Nimbus West was doing back in the day. And she's essentially sort of a modern version of that scene, like that Black liberation scene that was coming out of Leimert Park in the late 60s, early 70s.
Also, she was releasing, I mean, if you go back, I want to say early 2010s, maybe, she was also releasing music on what I don't think of as jazz labels, but she was doing jazz or deeply jazz-informed records in these other spaces. I think maybe she had a record on Ubiquity, which was sort of like a sort of soul into electronic label. And maybe there was a hip hop label she was putting out records on. I can't quite remember, but I feel like was doing work to bring this ideology kind of into spaces, like you say, before people were really planting a flag and being like, see, look at this. This is happening.
And she also releases jazz under her own label, some other ship, her and Dudley's label. That's another thing. She's long carried this mantle of just being indie and you know, sort of speaking your own voice and not trying to conform to what labels want you to do. You know, I always thought that she was a very important part of like the modern day jazz conversation because she was creating the style of free form jazz that now we celebrate, you know, whereas maybe 10 years ago, we didn't get the thing because we were coming out of an era of jazz that was quite honestly, it wasn't as prominent as it is now. So we probably didn't know what was coming out of those scenes.
Should we talk about Chicago while we're talking about scenes? Because I feel like any conversation that we're having about contemporary jazz the last few years, like you have to end up at least passing through. You got to drive through, even if even if you don't stay there for a long time, but you gotta spend some time. So we talk about what's been happening in Chicago over the last few years, talk about the International Anthem label. Marcus, you want to talk us through a touch of what's happening there?
Oh, man. I mean, the International Anthem label, at least for me over the past 3 years, it's been an instant purchase every time they announce. Like, I don't care what the record is. Once I get that Bandcamp, like, oh, this record is coming out. It's like, okay, done. Let me go buy the vinyl, you know, right now. You know, when I think of International Anthem, I think of a label that is allowing its artists to essentially create as best or create the sort of art that they want to create without compromise. And so as I'm talking now, the record that keeps jumping into my head, well, two records. One is Micaiah McRaven's Universal Beings record, which is like this amazing, amazing album that, you know, Micaiah does this great job of just getting in the room with different people in different scenes, you know, different places, like we were talking about earlier, and just rolling the tape and then just editing down from what he gets from these different spaces. So, you know, and he's also sort of this beat scientist where he'll take scraps from that and just make totally new instrumentals for other projects.
Micaiah last year put out Universal Beings E and F sides, which I presume is bonus content. Is that how we're looking at it? What's going on this record and what should we listen to it? Gio.
The whole record is great. Sometimes you end up thinking that like the stuff he saved was even better than the stuff he put in. And honestly, with Universal Beings, I almost felt that way. Track 4, The Hunt, is pretty great. Let's go there.
I also really loved, and I don't think people talked about this enough, was Junius Paul's Ism record. I want to say that came out in 2019. That was my favorite record of that year. I just say that to say that, you know, they pretty much are batting 1,000 right now, whether it's those two, whether it's Brandi Younger and Desiron Douglas, whether it's Jamie Branch, Rob Mazurek, Damon Locke's Black Monument Ensemble is an incredible album.
Shout out Damon.
Yeah, shout out Damon. Yeah, yeah. You know, International Anthem, I think they're my favorite label because they're putting out this music that sort of speaks to the time, but it also reminds me of old school jazz, you know, that comes from like Black Fire Records or Black Jazz Records or Indian Navigation, those old sort of underground labels, Strata, you know. To me, I guess, you know, we were talking about nostalgia earlier. It sort of taps into that nostalgia for me, but the artists on there do a really great job of sort of picking different things from the past, but spinning it forward into something present.
There's also this like light touch that they have creatively as a label, you know, that defines all the great labels somehow, where it's got its stamp on its, you know where that music comes from, but you don't know why, because the artists, like you said, are so empowered to do their own thing. It doesn't feel like the label's getting in the way creatively, but instead it's sort of embracing with intention this culture of musicians. And Chicago is the place where it is easy to do that, because I feel like the city really has a sound. It's deeper, it's darker a little bit than other kinds of, you know, instrumental music and improvised music. And so, yeah, like you said, Desiron Douglas and Brandi Younger are doing they're not even from Chicago, but they sort of had developed like a relationship with the label through just side person work with so many other members of the label. And it's like, you know, it's just a duo record, but it has that same quality of sort of like focus and vision, I would say, that like Rob Mazurek's big band record also has.
Oh yeah. So the Rob Mazurek record, which I believe was a favorite for both of you guys this past year, correct?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely for me.
Yeah, Marcus, you want to get into that? Because you interviewed him.
The thing that you understand when you talk to Rob right away is that he was hugely, hugely influenced by Sun Ra. And he talks extensively about the 1981 show that Sun Ra did at the Chicago Jazz Festival. And he was 16 years old and he's sitting in the arena, and he remembers just being blown away by this big sound. And by, you know, he was taken by the fact that Sun Ra could sort of orchestrate all of these like really, really wild threads at the same time, but it sounds like one harmonious tone. It's not until he explained that to me that I realized what he was doing with the Exploding Star Orchestra. It's the same exact. I mean, it feels like it's sort of, you know, the music sounds like he's traveling through space, like it's, you know, that sort of thing. And he does that on purpose. And so that's what I really love about Rob, is that he's the same way, where he has a very clear vision of what he's trying to do musically, creatively, but he doesn't tell Damon, okay, Damon, say the poem this way. Okay, Tamika Reed, blow the horn like this. He's essentially like, there's no such thing as like a bad note. If you're feeling it, if you felt good about it, we're going to put it on the record and we're just going to let it go, because it came from such a pure place that it can, you know, it can only sound good. It can't sound bad.
So the album is Dimensional Stardust. I thought this was like a very wild record, like really, really pleasurable. What do you guys want to listen to off this record?
Oh, man.
Also great song titles on this record, I should say. Great song titles.
Parable 3000 is kind of dope.
Towards the end? Yeah. Parable 3000. Yeah. We all come from somewhere else. Let's get into that. A little Exploding Star Orchestra. Marcus, I'm also glad that you mentioned the Sun Ra experience that Rob Mazurek had. Geo, on your list, there's a Sun Ra Orchestra album. It's called Swirling. I will say, of all the records, I listened to everything on your list. Of all the records, this one almost made me cry.
Wow.
Oh, man.
This one just, I mean, I don't know if I was just in that mood when I arrived at it, or I'm not sure.
Well, it would have helped.
Man. Yeah. Oh, it carried, like, for real, for real. I would love to listen to Space Loneliness. Just catch a little bit. I mean, it almost feels foolish, because it's just like, yeah, it's like you'll get like a cool 20 seconds. You'd be like, yeah, that's cool. But like, you really got to sit with it. You really got to live inside this thing. It was just, woo. Geo, so what can you tell us about the Sun Ra Orchestra album? I know it's the first orchestra record in quite some time.
The orchestra has been under the stewardship of Marshall Allen, who's now in his mid-90s and who was playing with Sun Ra since the 50s. For now about a quarter of a century, he's been holding it down through sort of thick and thin. And these days it's really looking up for the band in terms of, I mean, it's been sort of a renaissance for the past few years, with they're really being elevated in a way that's been beautiful to see, because of people like, you know, Mazurek and Damon Lox and so many other musicians, specifically on labels like International Anthem or Astral Spirits. There's subcultures of the music that hold Sun Ra dear. I think because what we're trying to do so much right now is like just figure out how we can get our memories and also our imaginations back, you know, like we want them off all the algorithms for a minute so we can think sometimes, or we just want, you know, we want a little bit more control over like the imaginative parts of our brain. And Sun Ra was always that, you know, he was sort of the guide to following yourself into a place that feels better in every way, you know? And that's why Mazurek must have been so struck by the experience of hearing him, because it like really is transportive. And in the same way that all of those Exploding Star Orchestra albums he's made are super transportive. And yeah, I think, John, you were talking about being really moved by the Sun Ra record. It's like, it really does try to pick you up and take you somewhere else, you know?
Yeah, I don't like to overstate kind of like the physicality of records because it just becomes a little bit of a crutch sometimes from a description perspective. But it did feel engaged, conversational, kind of like swaddling without being suffocating. And I don't know, just did a lot of work in a manner that I found like very emotionally present, perhaps in a moment when I needed such a thing.
There's always levels of work going on, right, on his records. Like the composition is really intense and also the agency he gives all the musicians within that composition. So you hear them representing this macro work that is like this masterpiece. It's almost like a really sketchily done, enormous, you know, Guernica-sized piece, you know, but like each line has been allowed to decide for itself which way to go, you know, it, like that you're hearing that. And that's like almost like observing an entire citadel, you know, like kind of transpiring in front of you. And you're like, wow, how many people's brains am I supposed to keep track of listening to this, you know?
Big facts. Big facts. I want to pivot slightly because I do want to get to something that Marcus and I chatted about a little bit before this recording. And also we touched on earlier, which is musicians like Pink Sifu and Earl Sweatshirt and folks who are embracing jazz approaches, bringing them into hip hop or perhaps bringing hip hop into jazz or perhaps living in some third space that draws liberally from both of those spaces and others. Pink Sifu had a very productive year. I think there's at least three records that I'm aware of. Do you want to talk a little bit about the music that's being made there?
I think with Pink Sifu, the record, I mean, he came out with a bunch of records last year and they were all great, but the record is got to be Negro. They came out in April. I mean, that record's amazing. And it's funny that we're having a conversation about Sun Ra because in having talks with him, he was saying how, you know, he was reading Sun Ra, you know, The Planet is Doomed, and he was listening to Sun Ra records and he was listening to old June Tyson, but he was also looking at Fred Hampton clips and Deborah Johnson clips. So he's pulling from all of these different things that, you know, for the sake of the listener, like they all sort of congeal in the movie Judas and the Black Messiah, you know, the sort of that era of film and of music. So Pink Sifu, he's inspired by all of this stuff musically, but then he's also obviously a person of, you know, of 2020, you know, and he's still a Black man in 2020, where one song in particular is talking about a run-in that he had with NYPD, you know, and then he goes home and he writes a song called Dead Meat, where, you know, the cop is essentially telling him, you know, hey, I can do whatever I want with you, you know, you're dead meat. But the thing about Sifu that I always have loved is that, you know, you can call him a rapper, but he's also a sound artist. Like he does this great job of sort of having his own orchestra where he's bringing in, you know, musicians like Navy Blue. He's bringing in Black Dynamite. He's bringing in Nelson Mandela, and they're all contributing to the sound. And it's rooted in hip hop, but it's also rooted in sort of like this dusty Black liberation jazz that I think is always, even if you're not of that community, it still resonates with you because it's just something about, I don't know, I can't even explain it properly, but it's just something about early 70s jazz that just hits different, at least for me. And I think he's fully tapped into that lane. And, you know, people like him, Earl Sweatshirt, same thing. But Pink Sifu especially had a record called Negro that I think, you know, everybody, no matter your race, you should be playing that record.
Have you had the chance to see him live? It's a weird question to ask in 2021, but I'm actually just curious if prior to everything that happened last year, had you had a chance to see him live?
Yeah, I didn't see him perform any of the Negro material, but he opened up for Anna Wise at LPR. That was a little bit before, you know, everything kind of went crazy, but he was performing other material, but he was saying like, no, I got this next record I'm working on, man, it might get me in trouble. It's like, wait, what are you talking about? And then it comes out and it's like, oh man, okay, I see. He was like, yeah, I was terrified to put this out, but just to see people wrapping their arms around that album is pretty inspiring.
Feel like the this generation, you know, we're talking about Pink Sifu, we're talking about Earl, obviously you can talk about folks like Mike. This generation of younger hip hop artists who are looking in this direction. Where do you see the trigger points being? Like, what turned this generation in this direction? Because I think when we think of sort of jazz-minded hip hop of an earlier generation, it felt almost more, I want to say, classicist. It was a little bit more like, we acknowledge the greats of the jazz that came before us. And this music feels, like you say, there's a dusty overlay on it. It's a little bit more, it's knottier. It's a little bit tenser in terms of the relationships between genres. And I wonder what you think was a kind of either a jumping off point or an inspiration point to bring this to the fore for this generation.
Obviously, the easy answer is, you know, the Kendrick effect, because you had somebody like him who was fearless enough to say, like, okay, yeah, Good Kid, Mad City, that was cool, but this next record is going to have some spoken word, it's going to be dark, it's going to have free jazz on it. I think, you know, an artist of his ilk being able to be that fearless, I think, sort of took the pressure off a lot of people. But I also got to give credit, though. I don't think enough credit is given to Flying Lotus for coming out with the You're Dead record in 2014, because that, to my memory, was like the first straight ahead jazz. Obviously, it had other stuff on it, other genres on it. But I think also, and this is a name that I've mentioned a couple times, but, you know, when I hear Pink Sifu, when I hear Mike, Navy Blue, Akai Solo, all of these people, you got to give credit directly to Earl Sweatshirt. And the thing about Earl is that in 2018, he came out with this album called Some Rap Songs. And on it was like these old straight ahead jazz loops. You know, he has Standing on the Corner on there. And
oh, we haven't even talked about Standing on the Corner.
I was about to say, Standing on the Corner. Oh, you also got,
wait, how did we get to like minute 57 or whatever without talking about Standing on the Corner? Jeez. Oh, God. Oh, man.
So, and also shout out like Jeremiah J. He's another one who's been sort of carrying that mantle. So I feel like, to answer your question, bro, like these people, you know, like the Sifus and the Mikes and all of them, they don't look to one person in particular. I think Earl is the biggest one, but at the same time, they're seeing what's going on, you know, in the LA jazz scene, and they're, you know, everybody has YouTube, so everybody's pulling up clips and they're looking at the past. They're looking at the voices of East Harlem and stuff like that. And they're pulling all this stuff together and they're being influenced in new and inspiring ways.
We talked a little bit earlier about either anxiety in relationship to the canon or lack of anxiety in relationship to the canon, right? And when you think about the jazz rap in the 90s, I think you're still dealing with a genre that at that point was still experiencing some anxiety with relationship to the canon. And therefore, there's this obvious gestural approach where it's like, we're sampling the important stuff, the important jazz musicians. They're part of us. We do what they do. They do what we do. And that was something that I think hip hop still kind of forming itself in popular imagination in order to be taken seriously. That was part of that narrative. But we're 2 to 3 decades past that now. And what I hear in Mike, what I hear in Earl especially, is almost a, I don't even want to say a rejection of that thinking. I want to say it's almost like that thinking just never even got to the table. It's so many layers past where we have been that it's like you don't even have to be like, do I have an anxious relationship with the canon or do I not have an anxious relationship with the canon? You can kind of just make the record you want to make, and then people like us will have that conversation after the fact.
Exactly.
You
know? Yep.
But it like doesn't enter into the narrative first, you know?
Marcus, don't you think it's because of, you mentioned YouTube and just like people on YouTube all the time checking out whatever they want to find, and the personalized sort of nature of like access to that canon, right? You can just do 3 or 4 jazz musicians and sort of be following the tradition in your own way. And that's broadened like who participates and where jazz creeps into, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then as a result, you have, you know, not only the newer generation, you have, you know, these records from the past, from Indian Navigation and these labels we were talking about. These records came out in like 75, 74. And they came out at a time when the public had sort of moved away from jazz as a genre. And now they have a whole new life. So now you have cats like, you know, Alan Broffman or somebody like that who is having a renaissance. So it's all these things working in concert together.
Right. You mentioned Nimbus West, like the label out in L.A. that was started by Horace Tapscott. And how it put out so much music that was sort of space and place specific in the 70s. And there is like one in every city, right? There's Strata Records, there's Strata East Records. There's just countless others in every city across the country, really every major city, of like sort of self-produced music. And I think, yeah, that's part of what's so attractive about it, is that people now get to go back and rediscover that and rediscover the imagination that it was not really valued at the time broadly because it wasn't popular and it wasn't seen as commercially valuable. But what it was rich in is like kind of this sense of like vast possibility, or also like, you know, a specific vision that kind of unifies all this music that was made in the 70s across the country, that's making people like Sifu or like Micaiah McRaven really hungry, or Georgia Ann Muldrow or Angel Bat DeWitt, even though she's not really sampling a lot. They're all going back to this music where it's a common sense of imagination that was not limited by the smallness of the community, but sort of in some ways enhanced by it.
I'm so glad that you tied those threads together. I think that's a really good place to wrap up the conversation. And I think seeing those common points of influence and also imagination between all the folks that we've been talking about today, that's really like the most exciting thing that I take away from this conversation. Gio Russinello, Marcus J. Moore, very happy to have you guys. Thank you so much.
No problem, bro. Thank you.
Thank you so much, John.
That is our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get on the Facebook group. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com with any questions. Subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. And also the Clubhouse chat. We're going to do that. We're going to do that soon. So get on the Facebook group. People are trading invites. We want to get as many folks from the group into the chat. If you have questions about invites, drop an email at podcast@nytimes.com. We will do our best to get everybody invites onto the Clubhouse app. And we're going to do that hopefully in the next week or so. Our producer, as always, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Let's go out with a little bit of that Earl sweatshirt that Marcus was talking about earlier. This is Earl with Standing on the Corner. It's called On the Way.
Yeah, my mood really swinging. I peruse like a native would do. What I'm thinking I should do for the sake of myself. No games with this cash. Go play with yourself. We stay on your ass. Your sense of safety melting a flash.